even though we're a little short on members here now because we have a long agenda, and with the encroachment of floor session on our morning time, we need to make sure we get our business done. We will be taking the agenda this morning in the order in which it's printed, and we'll begin then by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2349. Council Taylor. Council Stanford, go get him.
similar people.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2349 relates to sentencing. It provides for a presumptive life sentence without the possibility of release or parole for sex crimes involving forcible compulsion if the defendant has a prior conviction for a sex crime involving forcible compulsion. House Bill 2349 makes life without the possibility of release or parole the presumptive sentence for certain sex crimes involving forcible compulsion anytime the defendant has a prior sex crime involving force. The bill only applies to the following crimes, and only when these crimes involve forcible compulsion: rape 1, sodomy 1, unlawful sexual penetration 1, sexual abuse 1. ORS 163.305 sub 2 defines forcible compulsion as compelling someone by either 1, physical force, or 2, an express or implied threat that places a person in fear of imminent or future death or physical injury to the person or another person, or that places the person in fear of being kidnapped. House Bill 2349 does not apply to a defendant under 18. However, if the defendant is over 18, but received an adult sentence for a prior forcible sex crime when he was under 18, then I believe the sentencing enhancement would still apply.
I see that we have this actually the same sign-ups on 2350, and so I'm wondering, Mr. O'Leary, let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2350 as well. You can introduce that, Council, as well, and we'll hear on presentations on both.
On House Bill 2350, it relates to the crime of kidnapping in the first degree, an expansion to include kidnapping with the purpose of committing or facilitating a sex crime against the victim. ORS 163.235 defines the crime of kidnapping in the first degree, a Class A felony, generally as taking a person from one place to another or secretly confining a person in a place the person is unlikely to be found, with the intent of either A, compelling the payment of ransom, B, holding the victim as a hostage, C, causing physical injury to the victim, or D, terrorizing the victim or another person. House Bill 2350 adds a fifth intent possibility, that is, the intent of committing rape by force or with a mentally incapacitated person, sodomy by force or with a mentally incapacitated person, unlawful sexual penetration by force or with a mentally incapacitated person, or the crime of sexual abuse. If a defendant had that intent, then the crime would be kidnapping in the first degree as well under 2350.
Thank you, Council. We have Joe O'Leary from the Governor's Office.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here today representing Governor Kulongoski on these two bills, House Bill 2349 and 2350. For the record, my name is Joe O'Leary, Senior Policy Advisor for Public Safety to Governor Kulongoski. Council Stanford did an excellent job summarizing the key points of both of these bills. I have provided you with a low-tech PowerPoint presentation on paper that goes over some of the key points that your council has outlined with respect to both of these bills. The thing that I want to tell you preliminarily about both of these bills is that and for those, all three of you, I think I've met with previously to discuss the governor's public safety legislative agenda. And as you know, the outline of the bills that the governor has put into the hopper this session with respect to public safety are a blend of bills that focus on enforcement and accountability, treatment, and prevention, drug and alcohol treatment specifically, and prevention. And I'm happy to say that one of our access to drug and alcohol treatment bills has already passed both chambers, House Bill 2348, and we have several others that are in the works. These two before you today, however, are focused on the accountability piece. And what I have tried to do is focus these two sentence enhancements on the best available data that is out there with respect to recidivism. And what I have to offer you is a data-informed sentence enhancement. And slide two begins to explain some of that data. For the record, I have provided your council with three studies, one of which is referred to here in slide two. I'm just, for the record, showing you how thick. It's about 3 inches, 2 inches or so, the studies that these charts represent. But this first slide, slide two, shows you the comparative recidivism rate for sex offenders. And it's broken down between incest offenders, that is familial sex offenders, extrafamilial offenders who molest girls, extrafamilial offenders who molest boys, and finally, adult rapists. And you'll see from that chart that comparatively, the recidivism rate over time for adult rapists is high. It's not quite as high as extrafamilial molesters of boys, but it is higher than the other two categories. I want to give you some caveats on this chart and on the data that I've referenced from the reports that I've provided to council. And by the way, even before I give you that, let me give you a personal caveat, which is I didn't create this chart. It was created by Dr. Kurt Bumby, who is a researcher with the Center for Sex Offender Management out of Washington, D.C. That is an organization funded by the National Institute of Justice, which is the division of the U.S. Department of Justice. Dr. Bumby actually presented this information to the Interim Judiciary Committee over the interim in an informational session about sex offenders. That's the first caveat. The second caveat is that I don't want you to look at this chart and think that there is a particular profile for sex offenders, because if you review, which I really don't want you to do, all this data from these analyses and surveys that the experts have prepared, you will really see that there is no one profile for sex offenders. There is no one set of traits that predicts dangerousness or predicts future recidivism. What this chart demonstrates is a comparison of recidivism with different offenders compared to other sex offenders. The data also, I note and want you to appreciate, suggests that overall sex offenders have a relatively low recidivism rate. That is contrary, I think, to a lot of public opinion information that is out there in the media. But there's a caveat to that, too, which is that sex offenses are notoriously underreported. So the data that we have may be misleading about that issue. It might also be the result of enhanced incarceration over the years of sex offenders, that resulting in what appears to be lower recidivism rates because there is less of an opportunity for these offenders to access victims. So back to this chart, both of these bills focus on this yellow bar, which is the furthest one to the right in each of these columns, the adult rapists who perpetrate their crimes by the use of force. On 2349, I have outlined for you on about the fourth slide back, the fourth and fifth slide back, the four offenses that the presumptive life sentence would apply. And as your counsel indicated, it is only those sex offenses where the sub-element that is pled and proven involves forcible compulsion. Forcible compulsion is actually relatively broadly defined, and a couple of slides back you'll see that definition under ORS 163-305. It includes physical force, but it also includes a threat, either an express or implied threat, that places a person in fear of immediate death or injury. And the last thing I want to say about 2349 is to reemphasize that it creates a presumptive sentencing scheme. That is to say that it would require the judge to impose the presumptive life sentence unless the judge found substantial and compelling reasons to do otherwise. And examples of why a judge might do so are noted in that slide that explains the definition of a presumptive sentence. Then I briefly want to shift over to House Bill 2350, which is the kidnap enhancement bill. And like the first bill, this sentence enhancement focuses on that bar that represents the adult rapists who use force. And what it does is enhance the crime of kidnapping in the first degree to include an act where someone is taken or confined for purposes of committing one of those first degree sex offense, again, only where the sub-element pled and proven includes forcible compulsion, or where the victim is incapable of consent due to mental defect or incapacitation. And again, in the last two slides of the presentation, I attempted to sketch out to you the crimes that applies to, and I highlighted in red the two elements that would trigger the enhancement. Currently, the crime of kidnapping, if it is second-degree kidnapping, results in a mandatory minimum sentence of 70 months. And if this were to become law, if a kidnapping was perpetrated for in furtherance of one of these sex offenses, it would be enhanced to a first-degree kidnapping, which would result in a mandatory minimum sentence of 90 months as opposed to 70. I want to be clear that this would amend the statute that provides for mandatory minimum sentences. Unlike House Bill 2349, this would not be a presumptive sentence, but rather a mandatory sentence that would be required by the sentencing court to impose.
So, can you just walk me through that again, Mr. O'Leary?
Sure.
So the 2349 is a presumptive life sentence, whereas 2350 is a mandatory minimum?
That's correct.
Very good.
And the way that operates, Chair McPherson, is because 2350 is an amendment to the crime of kidnapping in the first degree. That is a statute that already lives under the section of the code that provides for mandatory minimum sentences, both for adults and youth who are 15, 16, 17. So the amendment goes right into that. It's built into that part of the statute, and the mandatory minimum sentence would apply. If Chair McPherson, if I could also mention, your question jogged my memory about one other issue that you asked me about yesterday, which was the potential application that the kidnapping enhancement bill could have to internet crimes against children, which I know has been the focus of some of the discussions in this committee in the past. And one of the fact scenarios that I wanted to spell out to you is that this 2350 really is intended to focus on the scenario where the perpetrator is apprehended by law enforcement before the sexual contact takes place, but after the victim has been confined or moved from one place to another against their will. And how this could apply in internet crimes against children is by under a fact scenario where there is email exchange between the offender and the victim, or an IP log of chat between the offender and the victim. The victim and the offender meet. The offender takes the victim to some place or confines the victim, and law enforcement is able to intervene before a sexual offense takes place. Law enforcement and prosecution could then use the email traffic, the IP chat between the offender and the victim, to and possibly any post-arrest statements of the offender to prove the offender's intent to commit one of these first-degree sex offenses, and therefore have the enhancement available to them at sentencing if the offender is convicted.
For those who arrived late, committee, this is Joe O'Leary from the Governor's Office, who's presenting on both House Bills 2349 and 2350. So we're in public hearing on both. Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, good to see you, Joe. It seems like during the interim we had something that talked about what motivated these types of crimes, and one was from sexual pleasure. And then one was from people who had want to have power or control. Are both of these types of people in both of these bills their motivation for committing those crimes?
McPherson, Representative Krieger. I think that the motivation behind why people commit sex offenses, I think you noted two of the ones that are in the literature. There are others. I think the literature reflects that it is very difficult to identify and categorize why exactly. But what I'll say with respect to these bills is that the individual motivation, whether it's power or sexual pleasure, does not matter. What matters is whether or not forcible compulsion, as defined by the statute, was used. And in the case of House Bill 2349, if someone had a prior conviction for one of those first-degree sex offenses where the sub-element was forcible compulsion, they serve their prison time, they get out, and they commit another forcible compulsion sexual offense. This gives the judge the ability to incapacitate that person for the rest of their life.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, do we have, in your opinion, effective programs, recovery programs for, you've got, like you say, the two different reasons people do it.
Yes.
And it would seem to me that if you're going to put someone in the in incarceration that long, part of that investment to keep from having recidivism should be a program to do the very best before we turn them back out, that they just don't make another victim. They go right back into the same crime again.
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, I think that's an excellent point. And I guess what I will say about the term that is used, sex offender treatment, the literature is mixed. Packet that contains the studies that I provided to you, to your counsel, there is actually some data that shows, and there were some bar graphs that I didn't include in this from Kurt Bumby from our interim, your interim presentation, that shows that sex offenders who are released and who are undergoing treatment have an even lower risk of recidivism, which is, to my mind, what, you know, we should be all about, looking for ways to reduce victimization that are cost efficient and that work. These two bills don't really focus on that. These bills focus on the folks, however, that have maybe had the opportunity to engage in that treatment and it hasn't worked, and who you may feel should not be given another opportunity and should be taken out of circulation, particularly 2349 should be taken out of circulation from the general population so that they do not have an opportunity to offend again. The other thing I'd really like to mention that is responsive to your question and is a little bit gratuitous to the governor's recommended budget, and if it is okay with the chair, I would love to mention it, is that the governor's recommended budget does include for the first time a relatively low-cost program that would be run by the Department of Corrections. It's not a sex offender treatment program, but it is actually a sex offender pre-release program that for the last 6 months before any convicted sex offender is released out the door of the Department of Corrections at the end of their mandatory minimum sentence, that person is going to have 6 months, 6 days a week, I believe it's 8 or 9 hours a day, of intensive preparation for what is going to be expected of them when they are on their term of post-prison supervision. And there is data that is supported by these studies that I've given to you that shows that that sort of pre-release and elsewhere, that shows that that sort of pre-release preparation of sex offenders before they leave reduces the likelihood that those sex offenders are going to reoffend. And to my mind, that is a great investment for reducing victimization, for reducing the cost to the system for folks who would otherwise take up law enforcement resources and prosecutorial resources and judicial and public defense services resources. And I hope that that particular program is restored in the ultimate budget that comes out of this body.
Representative Cameron. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe, it is good to see you. Would that 6 month treatment, or not treatment, would that 6 months of intensive education, if this bill were to be passed, would part of that education be in saying this is what's going to happen to you if you, I mean, would that be the kind of things that would happen in that six months?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I think that I'm not in the weeds on what the pre-release program includes, but I would absolutely think that part of it is the, you know, cognitive restructuring and preparation and making sure that those offenders are fully aware of the consequences of their actions if they step out of line. And this would, to my mind, certainly be relevant to that.
Thank you. Follow-up, if I may. On 2350, I think we heard testimony on another bill. I can't remember what it was. I think it's the Internet crimes that we heard testimony on, and we heard DAs testify that it's very difficult to prove intent. And so can you talk a little bit about, because I think that's what this bill would be setting us up for, is somebody who kidnaps with intent of doing these crimes. Can you talk about being able to prove that?
Sure. Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I think that proving intent in court comes down to specific evidence, either the statements, the post or pre-arrest statements of the defendant, a confession, or as I mentioned, possibly letters from between the defendant and the victim, emails between the defendant and the victim, IP chat between the defendant and victim, the statements of the defendant during the commission of the crime that are admissible in court, that may be offered by the victim or by friends or associates of the defendant who heard the defendant make statements with respect to his or her intent about what they wanted to do to the victim or intended to do. It may also be in certain attendant circumstances, such as the presence of child pornography and prophylactics and other things like that in the car that I'm thinking about individual cases from my prior life as an attorney and a practicing attorney, I should say, where the victim and the defendant are stopped in the car and it turns out that the victim was kidnapped and there are items in the car that suggests a sexual motivation for the taking of the victim. And that can be used as circumstantial evidence, which is enough to infer intent to a jury. Those are decisions, though, that prosecutors have to make with respect to the strength of their individual cases and have to make difficult decisions regarding the strengths of the victim's testimony and whether that will carry their case.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. O'Leary. And I want to talk, I have a specific question about 2349. I'm trying to ascertain the expansion. And because when I look at paragraph 1, that requires two prior sentences. And paragraph 2 adds this forcible compulsion and one prior conviction, if I'm reading it correctly. I'm having a hard time figuring out, excuse me, the extent of the expansion. And perhaps it's because I don't understand in paragraph 1 what sex crime there would be that didn't involve forcible compulsion.
Representative McPherson, Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, thank you for that question. You're looking at the actual bill, the text of the bill, 2349, in the paragraphs you're referencing. Let me explain. This is crafted as an amendment to an existing part of the code that's ORS 137719. And that section creates, if you will, a three strikes or life sex offense sentence. So under current law, if someone has upon conviction of the third felony sex offense, any sex offense, because it's the age of the victim, because it's force, because it's mental incapacity, doesn't matter. Any felony sex offense, third one, presumptive life. That's current law.
Right.
This bill amends that statute and carves out an enhancement for the felony sex offenses specific to forcible compulsion. not age, not mental or physical incapacity, only force, and says that if you have a second sex offense after a first where that involved force, the presumptive sentence is life. We're not going to give you three chances. We're only going to give you one, really.
Also, Stanford.
Thank you, Chairman Kirsten. Mr. O'Leary, I don't mean to put you on the spot on this one, but a question about 2350 that I have relating to kidnapping. And under existing law, kidnapping in the first degree, there are four mental states or four intents that can get you there. Ransom, hostage, cause physical injury, terrorize. What 2350 does is say we're going to add you intend to commit a sex crime, rape. Do you know, my gut reaction is, if I'm intending to commit a sex crime, aren't I terrorizing or causing physical injury? Do you know whether courts have resolved that issue? Sorry, Joe.
Chair McPherson, Counsel Stanford. I think I've already disclosed that I'm not been a practicing attorney for a period of time, so I'm not up on the case law. I'll tell you, if I were evaluating an indictment, however, I think that a very good argument could be made that if there are enough attendant circumstances to prove that the offender intended to commit one of these forcible compulsion first-degree sex crimes, that would probably be enough. But for the physical incapacity, that one's soft. There'd probably be enough to prove terror. But what this does is make it very explicit. I can't answer your question about current case law.
Okay. Thanks.
I bet there are others in the room that can.
Let her go first.
Representative Bonamici. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Krieger. On 2350, I must say I prefer the presumptive approach of 2349. 2350 is expanding something with a mandatory minimum sentence, so I'm concerned about the fiscal impact, and I wonder if you know how many people might be affected and what we're looking at in terms of numbers of people who aren't already covered by the subsections that Council mentioned.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, very good point. I want you to know the full fiscal impact of both of these measures. They will have a fiscal impact. I believe there is actually a prior referral to Ways and Means, and Council will correct me if I'm wrong, for both of these bills. There should be. With respect to your question, Craig Prinz, about the specific fiscal impact, Craig Prinz of the Criminal Justice Commission is here in the gallery and can answer that specifically.
Thank you.
Great minds must think the same, because that's exactly what I had written down here, is the impact and the numbers of people. I like the bill, but we need to understand what it's going to cost.
Any further questions? Mr. O'Leary, thank you very much. It's good to have you back in our hearing room again.
Thank you, and I do apologize. I have to leave in about 15 minutes, but I really appreciate the opportunity to present these bills to you. Thanks.
Very good. Actually, Lynn, did you want to come and present on the next bill because of other scheduling concerns, or did you want to, because we would have to just open the hearing for that presentation, then close it again, and then resume later with other witnesses. Do you prefer one approach as opposed to another? For you now. Yes, very good. We will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2494.
You've got to close the one you're on.
We've got two open now, so you have to close those?
Yeah. Well, wouldn't you? I mean, I don't maybe know.
Open one and we'll have everything open here for a bit. House Bill 2494.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. House Bill 2494 relates to possession of a drug called, known as salvia in short, Salvinorum A or Salvia Divinorum. Salvia, that's how I'll refer to it, is a hallucinogenic drug that was used by certain Indian tribes in Oaxaca, Mexico, in religious and healing rituals. It's presently legal under both federal law and Oregon law. In fact, it's only illegal in a few states. Louisiana, Missouri, Tennessee, Oklahoma, and Delaware presently ban possession. It is also a controlled substance abroad in certain countries, Finland, Denmark, Australia, and Italy. A person can presently purchase salvia at novelty stores, smoke shops, and adult video stores. You can buy a half-gram package, which is good for 5 experiences, for about $15. House Bill 2494 directs the State Pharmacy Board in Oregon to classify salvia as a Schedule 1 drug and to criminalize the possession as a Class A misdemeanor, criminalize the manufacture as a Class B felony, and delivery as a Class B felony.
Representative Lim, good to have you back in our committee again, although it's not been nearly so long as it was for Mr. O'Leary.
Thank you very much for opening public hearing the House Bill 2494. And I do appreciate it very much since I need to go to the other committee. For the record, my name is John Lim, state representative from District 50. It seems to me routine to see you almost every day, but glad to see you again here. Already your staff mentioned the House Bill 2494 would make it unlawful to possess salvinorin A or salvia divinorum. It would also make unlawful to manufacture or deliver salvinorin A or salvia divinorum. Also, the bill would require the State Board of Pharmacy, as already mentioned, to classify salvinorin A, salvia divinorum, as a Schedule 1 controlled substance. The bill is the product of work done last summer when my staff saw a report of a hallucinogen. Did I pronounce it correct?
Close enough. Hallucinogen.
Okay. Hallucinogen. That was available for minors. After research, my staff brought me some information, and I thought it would be a good idea to control these substances. The drug is not widely used yet, but it's gaining popularity. One Portland retailer selling a half-gram package to be good for 5 experiences for $15. For Silver Spoon, a shop in Portland that sells items such as glass water pipes, salvia is a strong seller, continually growing. According to Wikipedia and online encyclopedia, users have experienced side effects such as panic attacks, hearing voices, loss of speech, and report of experiencing alternative realities. But also at the same time, I read some benefit of usage of this drug. But I believe that the dangers outweigh some of the benefits of this use. The experience is quite different from the most of other psychoactives and may be overwhelming, even with a conducive, reassuring, and comfortable set and setting. Most salvia practitioners recommend darkness and silence as the best environment. However, minimal ambient or relaxing music can be helpful. Attempting to drive, operate machineries, or simply walking down the street while under the influence of salvia could potentially be dangerous not only to the user, but also those around them as well. Salvia is a long-term effect on the human bodies. Salvia's long-term effects on human bodies are still unknown. U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration has listed on the, quote, drugs and chemicals of concern, unquote. The agency is still investigating the drug. Currently, already mentioned, 5 states banned possession of salvia. Those states are Louisiana, Missouri, Tennessee, Oklahoma, and Delaware. 9 other states are considering ban on this drug. I think the main point to get across is that we want to keep this from minors and children. Also, we want to keep people from using this, get overly confident, and try to get behind the wheel. If we don't control now, it will be soon uncontrollable. Already we have enough problem with the drugs. We don't need to add one more. With that, I will conclude my testimony.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Lim. Are there any questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lim. I put this one in the Learn Something New Every Day column because I had never heard of this before your bill. Are you aware in the article that you passed out, there's an expert quoted who said there's no evidence that it's addictive. Are you aware of any problems in the state in Oregon about injuries or deaths or anything relating to this at this point?
Chair McPherson and the Representative Bonamici. And there's out there from the law enforcement agencies, and I think they can answer better than I do. And as you know, I'm very new on this drug issue, and I'm just bringing up to give some information. Hopefully, we can make it better.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. Representative Lim, I garden a lot. And I believe this is a common plant that you could put in your garden, and it has a pretty bloom, but I'm not a true horticulturist. Do you have any information if this is the same kind of plant we put in our gardens?
I don't have a full knowledge of it.
Okay.
And so maybe an expert behind hopefully can give you a better answer, but it's like a marijuana. It could be grown in any place.
Sure.
Yes, they can smoke. Sometimes they can make a tea out of it. And then it seems getting more popular at this time.
I might have to change my gardening plans.
I actually looked at a picture of it online, and I feel like I need to go check my landscaping.
Exactly. It looked very familiar.
Yes. All right. Mr. Chair, I could just see a couple of emails regarding this. And apparently, it is used widely in landscaping
right.
in California.
Right.
So, that's just a little factoid.
I think it has a real pretty red bloom.
Yeah. If there are no further questions for Representative Lim, thank you for coming to present on this bill.
Thank you very much. I do appreciate it.
Very good. We will leave the public hearing on House Bill 2494 open. We'll resume with where we were on House Bills 2349 and 2350 and proceed to the sign-ups for witnesses on those bills, to hearing them together. We'll go next to Herman Frankel.
Chair McPherson, members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Dr. Herman Frankel. I'm a member of the Governor's Council on Domestic Violence, and I'm here today representing the Council in support of House Bill 2349 and House Bill 2350. House Bill 2349, to review, provides for a presumptive life sentence without possibility of release or parole for a sex crime involving forcible compulsion if the defendant has received prior adult sentence for sex crime involving forcible compulsion. House Bill 2350 expands kidnapping in the first degree to include kidnapping with purpose of committing or facilitating a sex crime against the victim. The Governor's Council on Domestic Violence is charged by executive order to collect information on how a coordinated community response to domestic violence is working throughout the state, to work with communities to improve that response, and to keep the governor's office informed about response systems. We collect testimony from local officials and from survivors of violence. We recognize the need for improving the statutory definitions of crimes involving domestic violence and the need to amend sentencing statutes to address criminal behavior. We support the governor's proposal to amend these laws that are intended to strengthen the ability of state and local officials to hold perpetrators of their actions accountable. To hold perpetrators of violence accountable for their actions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Frankel. Are there questions?
Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Next we'll hear from Tim Sylvester from the Department of Justice.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Tim Sylvester, Department of Justice Appellate Division. Actually, I'm appearing both on behalf of the Department of Justice and on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, both of whom support both bills. Mr. O'Leary and his written and oral testimony pretty much covered both of these, as well as counsel's committee counsel's explanation. There are a couple of things that I want to add to clarify a couple of points. First, with respect to 2349, this is the one that will make a presumptive sentence for repeat forcible compulsion offenders. The important thing, I think, to emphasize about this is the life sentence that is required under this particular bill is merely a presumptive sentence. It is one that, by the terms of the statute, this ties in with the Oregon sentencing guidelines and allows a court, under some circumstances, if it can find substantial and compelling reasons, to depart from that presumptive sentence and to impose any sentence less than the maximum. So this is not something that in every case a person is going to get a true life or life without the possibility of parole. What this does is it gives the sentencing court discretion under existing case law that is well established under the sentencing guidelines to depart to a lesser sentence if that is appropriate. And so that is a bit of a safety valve for this if this committee is concerned about the fiscal impact. In fact, we recently had a case go through the Oregon appellate system in which a court had, using the current version of the statute, imposed decided to impose less than the life sentence on somebody who had been convicted of his third sexual offense. One thing I do want to say about this also is that this is just from my own experience. I've been with the Department of Justice, the Appellate Division, for 20 years. And when I first came here and started working on criminal cases, one of the things I was astounded at is the number of people who are repeat offenders in this nature, in the sense of committing forcible sexual offenses. And sometimes you will see somebody who will go to prison, be out, go out and offend again. And I remember cases where the person, just days after being released from prison, goes out and commits another forcible compulsion sexual offense. And, you know, there are some people like that, and this is the type of bill that is designed to capture those at the outset and get them incarcerated for a long time. With respect to House Bill 2350, this is the one that expands the definition of first-degree kidnapping. I do want to point out with respect to this bill, the Department of Justice has its own bill going through, it's Senate Bill 113, and there's hearings on that next week. That bill is different from this one in the sense that this bill expands the definition of first-degree kidnapping to include an intent to commit a forcible compulsion sexual offense. Our bill, Senate Bill 113, expands the definition of first-degree kidnapping to include sexual offenses against children. This one does not include sexual offenses against children unless it's also forcible compulsion. Ours covers only a kidnapping with the intent to commit a sexual offense against a child. Our bill, the purpose for that is to fix a problem that is created by the enactment last legislative session of Jessica's Law. But I guess we could deal with that when this bill gets over here. But it is important to note that this bill, 2350, covers only first-degree intent to kidnapping with the intent to commit a forcible compulsion offense. And committee counsel asked a question of Mr. O'Leary earlier about is this really necessary in light of the fact that first-degree kidnapping currently covers kidnapping with the intent to terrorize or to commit physical injury. And unfortunately, the answer to that is yes, it is necessary to do this because the current state of the law, at least as far as the interpretation of the current version of first-degree kidnapping, for example, it says to cause physical injury to the victim. The Oregon Court of Appeals has said, well, Physical injury is defined elsewhere in the criminal code as causing substantial pain or loss of bodily function. And so the court has said, well, physical injury to the victim perhaps would cover forcible first degree rape on the theory that a forcible rape would cause substantial pain or cause physical injury. But there are a variety, without getting graphic about it, there are a variety of different types of first-degree sexual offenses that will not cause substantial pain or will not cause loss of bodily function. And so even in those situations, if, for example, you kidnap someone with the intent of performing or causing this person to perform oral sex, that would not cause physical injury in the usual case. And so it would not fall within the scope of the current version of first-degree kidnapping. Likewise, one of the current provisions says to terrorize the victim, and the Oregon appellate courts have read that very narrowly and say the mere fact that the victim in the course of the kidnapping may be terrorized by the situation, that is not intent to cause to terrorize. Rather, it requires something additional of the offender to actually inflict or instill a great fear in the victim. And so in the typical situation, to the extent there is a typical situation where a person will kidnap another person with the intent of merely physically assaulting that person, that is not currently within the definition of first-degree kidnapping. And I think it is just from a standpoint, in my 20 years in the Department of Justice, this particular statute as it currently stands always struck me as rather an odd statute and almost misogynist, in the sense that if you have an offender who kidnaps somebody off the street with the intent of punching him in the face and then throwing him out of the car to cause physical injury, that person would be committing first-degree kidnapping. But if you kidnap a child, take him to someplace else and rape that child, that is not first-degree kidnapping. If you kidnap I think we had a case involving a man who grabbed a woman off the street and dragged her for several blocks and attempted to rape her under the bushes. That was not first-degree kidnapping because it was not with the intent either to cause physical injury or to terrorize. It was simply to sexually assault. And so it occurs to me, it's always occurred to me, that just from a simple notion of, I guess you would say, fairness, first-degree kidnapping should be broad enough to cover those kind of first-degree violent sexual offenses and be up there on par with to terrorize, to hold as a hostage, or to cause physical injury. And anyway, that's all I have, unless the committee has questions for me.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvester. Any questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sylvester, I wonder if you could answer the question that I asked. Were you here previously when I wanted to know about the how much we're expanding this because of the mandatory minimum sentencing, and I'm concerned about the fiscal effect, and how many instances are we talking about beyond what's already covered by A through D?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, you're referring to 2350, is that correct?
Correct.
And the answer to that is I don't know the statistics, and I'm not here to, I have not generated those, and so I'm not really sure how many more people will be involved. But as Mr. O'Leary explained, under the current version of 137719, it's essentially a three strikes bill that on your third conviction for any form of sexual assault, you will get the presumptive life sentence. What this changes, it is simply a two strikes bill for those in the very narrow class of people who commit forcible compulsion offenses. I suspect that it's a small number of people who fall into this, but as I mentioned earlier, there are some people out there who would, and those are the few people that we need to get in. The other thing I would point out is that if under the current law, even if it is only your second strike, and so you wouldn't be subject to the three strikes bill, if it is a forcible compulsion offense, it will fall within ballot measure 11, and the minimum sentence will be at least 100 months. And so what you have here, for these offenders, the difference really is between 100 months and life. And so I'm not exactly sure how much, what the impact of that will be actually on bed space over the long haul.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sylvester, in regard to House Bill 2350, I think perhaps I misunderstood you when you were making reference to the element of terrorizing the victim. Did I understand you to say that terrorizing would not necessarily include sexual assault or rape? Could you give me examples of something that would?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, yes, I think my understanding of the current state of the case law is that if you had a typical situation where someone kidnaps, say, a woman off the street with the intent of physically, sexually assaulting her and takes her to some place and actually does sexually assault her, that would not, under the current state of the case law, be a kidnapping with the intent to terrorize. What the courts have said is to terrorize requires an intent to to instill in the person great fear of, I think, death or serious bodily injury. And so if all you did was to sexually assault, that would not... in other words, the courts currently have construed the word to terrorize very narrowly. And I don't think it has been construed broadly enough simply to say if I kidnap somebody with the intent of committing a sexual assault, that is sufficient to be kidnapping with the intent to terrorize.
Well, here's a legal term. Wow.
Any further questions for Mr. Sylvester? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, Sybil Hebb.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb, and I'm a legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center, as you know. I urge your support of these bills on behalf of both the Law Center as well as the Oregon Alliance on Violence Against Women, which is a grassroots advocacy organization working to stop domestic and sexual violence. And I know that you're familiar with the fact that our expertise is in the civil arena, but we comment today in support of these bills because we know that low-income victims of domestic violence and sexual assault and their children are particularly vulnerable in our society. They are one of our highest priorities in terms of making sure that we meet the needs of vulnerable citizens, and unfortunately, suffering from sexual assault leads to a whole host of problems that are more than just in the criminal arena. It causes civil legal assistance problems, causes economic problems, health problems, and of course safety problems. And so from that perspective of the broader set of ramifications suffered by victims of sexual assault, we're here today to present our support of this approach, which provides greater accountability for high-risk perpetrators of these violent sex offenses, and we appreciate the committee's consideration of this effective tool in providing greater safety for victims. So thank you.
Good. Ted Barker.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hebb. I view these kind of crimes as the kind of the crime that keeps on giving. The victims really don't recover from that. I mean, I think a woman who's been, at least my experience and the people I talked to when I was working, after a rape, I mean, even years later, they're noisy, scare them. They're afraid to be out at night. I mean, that never goes away. And that, I mean, they're a victim for life from those events. And do you find similar...
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, and members of the committee, I agree, and of course the circumstances and experiences range, and there's a whole spectrum of reactions and issues that arise out of sexual assault. From my perspective, as a provider of civil legal assistance, it's clear to me, and I don't have a degree in psychology or counseling or anything else, but it's clear to me that people are suffering from what I would diagnose as post-traumatic stress and a whole host of other issues. But I have learned over the past 10 years that there is also a spectrum and I was surprised initially, of economic problems that are caused by sexual assault. For example, someone is unable to return to the home where she was assaulted. She's no longer safe there, or it's not a place where she can feel safe, needs to move. There are moving expenses. I mean, it can trigger a cycle of economic problems, housing problems, problems with respect to safety and parenting time, or in custody cases. So it's really a very complex issue, and I appreciate the question.
Thank you.
Very good. Representative Krieger.
I think Representative Barker pretty well covered it. I think we need to understand that in many cases, and I know a couple of them, their lives have been forever ruined, and they will never have what I call normal relationships of family, love, and that. It's gone. It's been taken away.
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, I would agree. It's an incredible violation. Sex offenses as well as domestic violence offenses have the same, I think, broad spectrum of ramifications for people. And some of the strongest and most inspiring people I've met have been people who have managed to overcome and put their lives together again. Unfortunately, sometimes with much less help than we would like. So, thanks.
No further questions, then. Thank you, Ms. Hebb.
Thank you.
That concludes our public hearings on House Bills 2349 and 2350.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, before you do that, Craig Prinz is here, and I think maybe we can answer the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Mr. Prinz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Craig Prinz from the Criminal Justice Commission. I didn't sign up, but I wanted to be here in case questions came up regarding the fiscal, and so if I can briefly do that in general. I think rather than answer Representative Bonamici's question directly, I think if I look at the fiscal on House Bill 2349, it will help to understand House Bill 2350. You heard the testimony from Mr. O'Leary and Mr. Sylvester. The way I looked at the fiscal for 2349 is we looked at, I think the question when you're looking at our data is the hard thing is determining what theory of law was used when a conviction was sustained, because as what the testimony was given, for rape one, it could be force, it could be the age of the victim, it could be the helplessness of the victim, or in a very rare it would be a familial relationship between the defendant and the victim. So we looked at Multnomah County data, because in Multnomah County, the way the computers work, you can actually see the way that the prosecutor, what theory of he used or she used to sustain the conviction. And so we looked over almost an 11-year period at the four crimes in 2349, and we got there were about 570 cases over that period. So These are cases that have a big prison impact as far as the sentence. There are relatively few of them compared to the other type of crimes we look at. We then looked at, of that 570 over that 10-11 year period, excuse me, I have a cold, and so I'm going to hopefully not lose my voice here. We looked at the percentage that were force, and it was 136 of those were force. So it was about a quarter of them were situations where the prosecutor used the theory of force. And so for 2349, we used that to analyze. Thank you, sir. For 2349, we used that information to figure out. So you didn't take those ones that used force one time. And we then went to Oregon State Police LEDS records and looked at their old criminal history to see how many of them would have had a situation there where they would have, qualified for a situation like 2349 where you had to have the two priors for forcible compulsion. To keep in mind that under the grid, if you commit rape one, sodomy one, with force, if you use a weapon or anything, you're up to a 10, a level 10 anyways. It's either going to be a 9 or a 10 depending on the circumstances. And if you already have at least one prior felony, the guidelines would take you for a 10 would be actually over the minimum. For a 9, it would be under the minimum. of 100 months. But so for some of these, they would be getting longer sentences under the guidelines. And when we looked at what offenders like this were getting, where they had a prior, the average sentence was about 12 years, which is longer than the Measure 11 sentence. So on 2349, then the issue becomes how many people are going to qualify. And we looked at it to be about, we looked at it two ways. And I think what we came up with was it'd be a couple a year if prosecutors didn't change the way they handled cases. But it would be about 8 a year if you assumed that prosecutors aren't going to plead down those cases anymore. Meaning, when a prosecutor knows if I get a conviction for a guy or an offender where I can, I'm not going to take a plea unless he pleads to using force to one of those four crimes, so that if he does it again, he's out. So using all that and assuming that these people are not victims under 12, because you could use force on a child and the crime would be a 300-month sentence, even using all that, the fiscal starts in the year 2020, bottom line. And in 2020, you'd have somewhere between 2 and 8 offenders, we estimate, but depending on how the prosecutors apply it. And that's when the fiscal would start. As you push it out, you would be seeing by about it, and this is way farther than I usually try to do a fiscal, so it gets a bit attenuated. But as you went a decade after that to about the year 2030, you would be seeing a large number of people possibly going to prison on this, maybe up to 45, 50 a year. That's a fiscal that, again, I'm pushing way out because I'm trying to make sense of things, and I think it's hard to do that when you're looking that far out. But that's, so I think the important thing for the fiscal is I don't see a fiscal occurring until the year 2020. As this ramped up in later years, it would have an impact on the prison forecast at about 100 a year, possibly, if my numbers are right.
And I might just comment for the committee just to underscore something that we've become aware of in prior sessions, but for those who are new in the committee, one of the things about fiscal impact, the way it's analyzed in the legislative process, is that ordinarily our fiscal impacts only look at the next two biennia. And so the issues like this, which increase the length of already serious offenses, don't impact the near-term fiscal impact, but they do have a long-term consequence that our successors someday will be dealing with the fiscal consequences of. Representative Bonamici, did you have a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted a clarification, please. Mr. Prince, thank you very much for addressing this. You were talking about Multnomah County numbers, so does the 2 to 8 per year by 2020 apply to Multnomah County?
That's the whole state.
That's for the whole state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, that would be the whole state. And what we did is we took the percentage. You know, Multnomah County is 17% of people for these convictions are from Multnomah County. They're about 20%, 25% of the general population of the prisons, and we already multiplied out. The reason it's such a small number is you have to have two very, you know, serious, you know, two sex crimes where there's forcible compulsion. I looked through the statutes. There really are only these forcible compulsion. It makes it a first degree in all the situations I saw. So you'd have to have two of those. And that's why it's a low number.
Thank you.
So, from my perspective, I'm looking at it a little differently. If you say way down the road there's going to be 50 people, and these are violent, repeat, predatory offenders, then we're going to probably save hundreds of victims.
That's right. Mr. Chair, Representative, as you know, that's right. I mean, I have to try to do there's a weird world of the fiscal budget world that I am trying to work within, but obviously you'd be avoiding, you know, as if you talk to the experts on prosecuting these, they're hard, we don't arrest and convict a large percentage of those who are actually victimized. And so, yes, you would be avoiding victimization for a lot more people than that. And so just to close on, then on Representative Bonamici's question on 2350, I honestly was in the same boat as Mr. O'Leary that I have not practiced and didn't know the case law that Mr. Sylvester talked about. On the on that fiscal, then what you what we'd be looking at is a case where you could prove the kidnap, and right now it would be a, possibly a kidnap in a second degree because you couldn't prove that you were going to terrorize or cause physical injury, so it would be a kidnap too. That's a 70-month sentence anyways. It would be a situation where you could prove a 70-month kidnap, but the offender did not actually rape, sodomize, or penetrate, because if they did that, that actually has a longer sentence than the kidnap one. That is a 100-month sentence. I'm having a hard time. What I'm going to have to do on that one is to honestly say I do know that the force, so the forcible compulsion, which is rape one under those two statutes, it's either force or I think D is physical helplessness. It's about a quarter of all of them. And it would have to be a situation where it's a very, I think it's a very, it's more of a trying to make the statutes make sense in light of Jessica's law than a case where we're going to be having a lot more prosecutions. And I'm going to have a hard time figuring out how many it's going to be, because it would have to be where you could prove they had the intent to commit a forcible act, but they didn't commit it. And it's kind of that situation that Mr. O'Leary's talked about, and I'd have to look at how many times a prosecutor was able to convict on kidnap two and attempted rape, and that's what I can do for the fiscal. That's how I will do the fiscal.
Mr. Chair, I don't need a lot of detail.
Okay.
I just if this has to go to Ways and Means, I'm assuming
okay.
that they will. And there's some indication that it
well,
does.
But just a cautionary word on that. The responsibility of Ways and Means is to deal with the next biennium,
right.
Yeah.
and then look ahead to the one after that. But these things that have a ripple effect out 10, 20 years, it's not really their charge specifically. So I think we as policymakers have to think about those long-term impacts on our prison population. Representative Krieger.
Real quickly, Greg, I'd like to know the average age of the people, and if you're going to increase the sentencing, what would be the age when they get out? Because we heard some testimony, you get to, I think it was age 65, the recidivism rate of certain types of crimes just drops right off.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, you're talking about the average age of the offender. That was one of the things when we figured out when you already have these longer sentences, you know, what's the life expectancy of these folks that are in DOC that are going to be of that age? And that's how we came to that fiscal, because I think that, and you're right, the data I've seen is that recidivism rate does drop off. So we'll try to do that. But the bottom line is, on 2350, I don't think there's, the fiscal is really, I can't hardly find one. On 2349, I think that'd be a substantial one, but it would be in about 25 years.
Thank you, Mr. Prinz.
Thank you.
Late volunteer here, Amy Alconich, and we don't want to spend very much time on Alconich, but I wanted to get all the input we could here today on this before we go to these other bills.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, member of the committee. I'm neutral on this bill, but I did want to, unfortunately, my computer just crashed with the actual definition of terrorized, but I did want to provide the committee, we are neutral on these bills. I think that in some instances they provide an additional tool for prosecutors to work on these cases. The case is State v. Bodenschatz, and it's a pretty old case. And the way that it defines, and this is from my memory, I was going to pull my computer up, but it just died, is to go farther than the actual definition of kidnap. And I missed Mr. O'Leary's very beginning. So kidnap is to move an individual from one place to another place. And first degree is to add an intent to commit a more serious crime like the ones that are in sections A through D of the statute. And to terrorize is to engage in a vengeful, this is a very brief instead of elongated paragraph, but to engage in sadistic or vengeful activities. When I just did some research online during the testimony, I did find that there were a lot of cases where that did apply to rape, sodomy, unlawful sexual penetration, and sex abuse. I'm not saying that there aren't some instances where that may be difficult for the prosecutors to prove, but that the way that is defined in the Bodenschatz case, it does appear that terrorize can, in some instances, apply to sex crimes. So I think that that may address some of counsel's questions, and I'm happy to provide that case. I just can't provide it right this second.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Aponich? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will now close the public hearings on House Bills 2349 and 2350. We're still open in public hearing on House Bill 2494, on which we had introduced by Representative Lim, the chief sponsor here earlier. I'd like now to invite Mike Heintzman to present.
Thank you, members. My name is Mike Heintzman. I am with the Forensic Services Division of the Oregon State Police. I hadn't really intended to offer testimony, but just to answer questions about fiscal, as far as the forensic analysis of Salvia, if there are any.
Mr. Heintzman, I didn't understand. What's your connection to the issue here?
I'm with the Forensic Services Division of the Oregon State Police. We would be doing the analytical testing of the substance if the bill passed. And they said I wasn't going to offer any testimony, but when I was doing my research, I was looking strictly at the chemical composition of Salvia A, so now I'm going to have to go home and check my landscaping also.
Okay. Representative Krieger.
Thank you. How long is this, if you use it in some form, how long does it remain in the system that you can detect?
We don't know. We've done very limited research on it so far. I'm not sure if it's as long-lasting as the metabolite for THC, the active component in marijuana, which I believe can go 60 to 90 days. We're not sure how short-lived it is.
Counsel.
Do you know whether you can perform a NIC test? And for members of the committee, NIC is a field test that officers will use. I think it stands for Narcotics Identification Kit. They can have with them in the field. Do you know if Salvia can be NIC tested?
It has. Last time I looked, it was 2 weeks ago. It's not available yet, but as more states start to regulate it, I'm sure they will develop a NIC test for it.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Heisman, have you seen instances where this has been the focus of investigation by Oregon State Police, and have you seen any rise in use and reporting?
We really would have no idea because it's not regulated at this point. What we've seen are approximately 5 cases coming in a year for testing that officers thought was marijuana. That's the only thing we've seen of it in forensics.
Follow-up?
Me?
And the testing that you have done, does it, you determine that to be an hallucinogenic?
We don't test for, what we're doing is testing for a chemical compound. What its properties are in the body, we don't know. I don't know. According to what I've read in the DEA, it is a hallucinogenic, either smoked or I believe you can chew it. You can also extract the salvinorin A out of it and make a pill out of it and inject it that way. It's supposed to be a short-term hallucinogenic, I think 30 minutes to an hour.
Thank you.
Mr. Heintzman, would a person who is under the influence of salvia, do you know whether they would be impaired if they were driving, for example, and would they be prosecutable for DUI?
I don't know, but from what I read on the DEA documentation, it would certainly seem so. And at that point, if they have an impairment, it would fall into a toxicology testing for us for DUI support. It would seem from what I've read of it that, yes, they would be impaired while driving if they're under the influence of it.
Okay. Representative Flores.
Well, one of the letters that I received from someone who calls himself a researcher says driving under the influence of salvia should be illegal. but there are no breath or other tests available for the presence of this compound in the body. And there should be legal penalty. So if someone who is an advocate for against this bill thinks that driving under the influence of this particular herb, I don't know what to call it, should be illegal.
Councilman Stanford.
Chair McPherson, in response to that question, my understanding of existing Dewey law in Oregon, you need alcohol, an inhalant, or a controlled substance. It's none of the above. Right. It's not a controlled substance right
this
now.
Time.
So you are unquestionably impaired, but the charge would have to be if there was an accident or something involving a driver who was using salvia, you cannot charge him with the Dewey. It would be charging him with reckless driving for their impairment. But it's not a controlled substance, so it would not meet that definition.
There are no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Heinz.
Thank you.
Gail Hypine.
I'll go home and try.
No, I was.
Good morning. My name's Gail Hypine. I signed up to testify against this bill, but I'm not exactly testifying against the bill, but rather testifying for a modification. I would rather see it modified for age restriction. I've been over 18, or better yet, over 21, like alcohol would be even better. I've been a teacher for 22 years, and I'm very concerned about issues with young people and substance abuse and so on. But I'm also speaking as someone with personal experience of salvia divinorum and as a member of an internet community that does research on the therapeutic uses of salvia. And I think that I can address some of the questions that have been put to some of the other witnesses. But beforehand, I'd probably like to clarify a few points. First of all, the question about the gardens. It's basically not hardy enough to grow in this area. It is grown as an ornamental, widely grown as an ornamental in California. It's easily grown as an indoor plant. But the doses with hallucinogenic effects are artificially concentrated, 10 to 50 times the natural level of. So if you did have a plant in your garden and you smoked a leaf of it, you would feel little more than a little bit of an antidepressant effect. It's when many pharmaceuticals, if you were to concentrate them at that level, they're like 50 times the normal dosage would cause some sort of hallucinations or some sort of impairment or some effects like, you know, some young people have been drinking concentrations of dextromethorphan, which is cough syrup and so on, because at high doses it causes similar effects to that. So that's one thing that needs to be clarified, is that the natural plant, the people who are concentrating this plant, they're not growing it locally, they're not growing it in the United States. They import it from Mexico in quantities. So there's really no reason in the first place to concern ourselves with the natural plant. In Tennessee and Georgia, the preparations for human consumption have been banned, but the plant is allowed to be grown. And I want to clarify that in Oklahoma, the salvia divinorum has not been banned across the board. It's just these concentrated extracts that have been banned. But in its natural, the natural leaf is not banned because the effects of the natural plant are mild. I'd also like to say that it's a little bit misleading to say that it's gaining popularity, because more young people are trying it because it's getting more publicity. And a lot of the publicity is coming from the fact that some states have banned it, which makes, you know, young people curious about some sort of this forbidden fruit effect. But the fact is, it's not exactly pleasant. And most people who try it, who don't repeat it after trying it once. I mean, if you read this article, nobody actually comes out and says that they liked it. And only a small minority ever try it a second time. It's, in fact, as Representative Lim said, it frequently causes frightening experiences. I'm talking about these high dosage. It frequently causes frightening experiences or panic attacks. Most people with a panic attack don't want to repeat a panic attack. You know, they're It's used by adults for therapeutic purposes under, as Representative Lim described, the way it's communicated in dark rooms with the ambient music and so on, in order to do like psychotherapeutic self-exploration, but also has very interesting anti-addictive effects and with respect to other drugs. It has been discovered through empirical experience that people who are addicted to cocaine actually get a temporary relief from their craving for cocaine that may last for weeks after one salvia experience, or the same effect with opiates. And there have been there's research being done as a result of this these reports that it's anti-addictive. Research being done at the University of Iowa, University of North Carolina, and the University of Mississippi on anti-addictive effects, and they've actually found that there's like, since the cocaine and opiates have different effects on the brain, that salvia actually addresses both of these brain mechanisms, and so in two different ways it actually helps to relieve addictive effects of both both opiates and cocaine. And in addition, it has because of these you might say that this, what you're calling a hallucinogenic effect, is like a dream, like it puts you very suddenly in a strong dream state, and you're able to like analyze dreams. And so very often, it's very common for it to bring you back to a dream that has a scene of childhood, of early childhood. So someone who's had a traumatic effect in their childhood actually can relive that as though they're there, and can deal with that. And most people who are using salvia and this in a therapeutic way might use it a few times a year, because it gives you a lot to think about. You know, if you have one of these sort of profound dreams, some psychotherapeutic effect. You don't need to keep doing it.
Ms. Highpine, I'm going to break in here at this point because we're getting closer to the end of our time. We've got two more bills we need to hear today. So,
okay, the driving issue, by the way.
Very briefly, are there particular perspectives you think that this witness would be able to help out with the committee?
Ms. Highpine, thank you. I think that I have one of your letters that you sent. If the rest of the committee does not have that letter, I'd like to
actually
make copies of that.
I have it in my file.
So
I'd like to quickly address the driving issue. Someone who's already under the effects of salvia divinorum is not likely to get behind the wheel of a car. They probably don't know what a car is. The problem is with kids who don't know the effects and light up when they're already behind the wheel. And if they do that, they're going to crash. I mean, in effect, it's like falling asleep behind the wheel. I mean, you know, because it removes them so, its effects are very sudden, and in fact, they're not even aware of what's going on. I mean, there's no way that they're going to, you know, smoke salvia and not have an accident. So, you know, if that's covered under reckless driving, then that's, then that's already covered, because, you know, it's absolutely totally unsafe to smoke, you know, use it when you're behind the wheel of the car. But as I said, somebody who's already under the effects is not going to try to drive. So are there
any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Highpine. We appreciate your coming to present. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2494 and open a public hearing on both House Bill 2651 and 2819. Well, there's nobody else signed up. Well, I will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2494. We have Susan Jones signed up. Ms. Jones, we have very limited time this morning, so if you could be very brief. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much, Chairman Henderson and members of the committee. My name is Susan Jones. I'm from Portland. I am a parent. I was a public school teacher and a counselor. I have done drug education. I know many people who have used salvia divinorum, including some adults. I know people who grow the plant as a very beautiful house plant. I won't repeat anything that Ms. Hypine said. I am have done the same kind of research she has done. I'm very familiar with it. I will answer any other questions that you have. I also believe that it should not be scheduled as a Schedule I substance for the reasons that she stated. It has no record of serious abuse. As long as people are educated to its effects, as long as they don't use it while behind the wheel of a car or out moving around, it needs to be used only at home with someone else present to keep people from getting up, walking around, leaving the house, trying to be mobile. People do not show up in the emergency room under the effects of it. It is non-toxic. It causes no physical damage, at least not to our knowledge at this point. People do not repeat the use, even long-term use. Those who try it again and again is decreased over time. I am concerned with our young people that if it does become scheduled, the glamour factor will be increased, as it has been in the states that it has been scheduled. And the young people will then try to get it on the black market and will come in contact with criminal element and genuinely dangerous drugs. And most important, the law enforcement system will become burdened with the expense and the extra effort of trying to enforce laws that they probably will have difficulty enforcing. I think more education is needed, that if it can be regulated, sold only to people over 21, packages can be labeled with the very serious consequences of trying to use it while driving. We'd be much better off educating our young people, making clear what the risks are, because they are real, but minimal. It does show promise as a therapeutic agent, and it should be not the research on it should not be limited, as would happen if it were scheduled.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. Are there any questions?
Yes.
Thank you, ma'am. We appreciate you coming in. I'm sorry I didn't have your name on the main list.
That's no problem. Thank you.
I will now close the public hearing on House Bill 2494 and open a public hearing on House Bills 2651 and House Bill 2819, both of which deal with related subject matter. Kevin Campbell, and I see we have a panel that you're maybe going to introduce. Oh, I'm sorry, Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. I'll summarize House Bills 2651 and 2819 together because they both go to the same issue. ORS 165.540 generally makes it a Class A misdemeanor for a person to record conversations without the knowledge of all participants. There are certain exceptions. Some of those exceptions include, but aren't limited to, jail conversations and then the recording of any conversation during a felony that endangers human life. The issue that 2819 and 2651 both seek to address is the fact that many officers have video recording devices in their police vehicles, and they will oftentimes use such vehicles in connection with traffic stops. Officers will tell the subject of the stop that the conversation is being recorded, but it's also quite possible during a lengthy traffic stop that persons who are not the subject of the initial stop come into the recorded area. And so what these bills seek to do is to create an exception for uniformed public safety officers. Real quickly, House Bill 2819 adds a new exception for a, quote, uniformed public safety officer. That is, they're not subject to a Class A misdemeanor for recording conversations without the consent of everyone. So 2819, the exception is uniformed public safety officer. In House Bill 2651, the exception language is, quote, law enforcement officer, but then there are more specific limitations in 2651. Officer must be in uniform, displaying a badge, and operating a vehicle-mounted video camera that records the scene around the vehicle for the duration of an event that began as an effort to enforce a traffic or vehicle law. And there is also a -1 amendment to House Bill 2651 that specifies that this exception does not apply if the officer has a reasonable opportunity to inform all the participants that the conversation is being recorded.
Thank you, Council. Mr. Campbell.
Thank you, Chairman Pearson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I'm here today to speak in favor of the -1 amendments to House Bill 2651. I did want to mention that as a lobbyist, we experience panic attacks without the need for the use of salvia divinorum. So there's a natural way of achieving that just by being involved in the process. I want to mention that the Dash 1 amendments are really grow out of a work group out of a work group. There was initially a work group on House Bill 2134. That's a bill that you're going to hear in this committee next Thursday. It was a broader bill dealing with more comprehensive bill dealing with the interception of wire, electronic, and oral communications. And there was a small section in that bill, Section 2 sub 8, that dealt with the issue that you're dealing with this morning in this bill. We decided to take that out of the bill, discuss it separately, and introduce a separate bill. And so we've been meeting over the last month or so, a group of us, including Amy Elkanovich with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, Andrea Meyer from the ACLU, Brenda Wilson from the City of Eugene, who is here with me, Mark Landauer with the City of Portland, and myself, in order to try to work out appropriate amendments that we could agree to. And I think you'll find that people will be up in front of you this morning testifying that, in fact, we support the amendment. Of course, it does create a narrow exemption to the requirement to give notice in situations where you can't reasonably do so and you're operating a vehicle-mounted camera. I think that the original goal was to make sure that surreptitious conversations were not being recorded without the person's notice. And, of course, with the advent of new technologies in law enforcement, such as the vehicle-mounted camera, it is, in some cases, difficult or impossible to give notice because of the situation they're coming into contact with, or because, as committee counsel mentioned, the fact that people are coming in and out of the conversation. And so I'm not going to go into detail about that because we do have actual representatives of the Portland Police Bureau and Eugene Police Department here to speak to the specifics. I do want to mention, for the purpose of the committee, we received these amendments yesterday afternoon, and there's one word in the amendment that we'd like permission to have the committee look at having removed and maybe the amendment further adjusted. In line 3 of the amendment, the word all that follows the word inform showed up in the amendment, and I don't think it was intended in our original request, and we would like permission to have that word removed based on conversations that occurred during the committee today. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will thank the committee for your time on this measure and turn it over to you.
Yeah. Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Wilson. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Manager for the City of Eugene. And I know you're short on time, so I'll keep my comments brief. The City of Eugene strongly supports this bill. In fact, through the interim, we worked on our own legislative concept, which was drafted into a bill through Senator Prosansky's office. Instead, we've decided to work with the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, the Portland Police Bureau, and the other parties that Mr. Campbell mentioned in order to back this particular measure. The City of Eugene is concerned with the current law because the law does not require a culpable mental state. If a police officer finds themselves in a situation which does not provide an opportunity for them to give this notice, they can accidentally or inadvertently commit a Class A misdemeanor. We are looking for an exception for our uniformed police officers who find themselves in positions where they cannot reasonably give the notice, perhaps due to their concerns about their own safety or the safety of those in the surrounding area. Although we would like the notice requirement to be on their minds, perhaps it shouldn't be the number one thing on their mind when safety is concerned. Again, we'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present our position on this bill, and we strongly support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Any questions? Then if not, I think we have a panel then coming up, Mr. Campbell, that of Mark Kruger, Tom Larson, and Pete Karras for Kearns. Whatever order, gentlemen.
Go ahead, Mark. Committee members, my name is Mark Kruger. I'm a lieutenant with the Portland Police Bureau and the acting commander of the Portland Police Bureau Traffic Division.
Good question.
I think the need for this change to the legislation has been summarized very well by what's been said so far, but I would just add to that by saying that the issues that concern our officers principally are the fact that officers who are out on patrol encounter very fluid and rapidly changing incidents from time to time. And when an officer is encounters crimes in progress or violations or traffic collisions that occur right before them, very often their train of thought is more directed at gaining control of the situation, coordinating the response to the situation, ensuring their safety and the safety of others that are present in those circumstances. And oftentimes the need to remind folks that they've got an in-car camera system with a recorder going slips down the list somewhere. And so we just like to recognize that those are concerns that officers have and that this is a very sensible change to the current existing legislation to protect officers from being criminally liable under these cases.
Very good.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I'm Officer Thomas Larson, a police officer with the Portland Police Bureau, signed a traffic division for about 14 years. I'm also the project coordinator for our in-car camera program pilot that's going continuing again after selecting a new vendor. I concur with Lieutenant Kruger said. I'm more here for questions. I do have firsthand contact with the officers that use the systems on the street. I go out and test the systems when they're installed, and so I can, if there's any further questions, I'll be happy to answer those on a technical standpoint.
Okay. Thank you, Officer Larson.
I'm Captain Pete Kearns, Patrol Division, Eugene Police Department. I am also the project manager for our in-car video implementation project. The Eugene Police Department has more than half its fleet outfitted with digital in-car video systems, and within the next month or two, every one of our patrol cars will have a system in it. All of our patrol officers and sergeants have been issued wireless microphones that sync up with each of the systems and removable hard drives that store the information that is recorded in each of their contacts on the street. The systems automatically activate whenever the emergency lights are turned on in a patrol car for a stop or other purposes, and can also be turned on by the patrol officer either in the car or remotely with the wireless microphone. Our policy requires that in every stop as defined by ORS that occurs within the operational radius of the patrol car, officers are required to activate the system and record those encounters. As has already been stated, many of those encounters are very dynamic, and it would be unsafe or unreasonable to expect an officer to put at the top of their priorities the notification to people that their encounter is being audio recorded. And each of us could give you many examples of those high-risk car stops, for instance, of stolen vehicles or disorderly subjects, bar fights. In Eugene, we have riots of every scale in the West University neighborhood, and it's unreasonable for officers in situations like that to find a way to notify all those people that they may end up having a conversation with that their conversation is audio recorded. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about that.
Any questions for members of this panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was tempted to ask you whether you were impugning my alma mater with that comment. I'll leave that be. Is there anything in 20, and perhaps I should have asked Mr. Campbell this, is there anything in 2819 that's not covered by 2651? Because 2819 just makes the exception apply to a uniformed public safety officer, but the language is different in 2651 because it's a law enforcement officer as defined in ORS 133726. I'm just trying to figure out if there's a difference or if everything is within the 2651 version that covers a law enforcement officer as defined.
And in fairness to this panel, I think that they're coming to present on House Bill 2651 and may not have even been aware of the other bill that's overlapping. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to be sure, so we're talking about the cameras running on a car, but not that you would walk up to somebody and start talking to them and not tell them you're recording?
That's correct. This focuses on camera use that's in the car and extraordinary circumstances. And as the captain pointed out, for routine contacts, we always advise that they're being recorded. This would just be under for our concerns, the extraordinary contacts where other priorities come first.
Okay, thank you. And just for the panel's information, Officer Larson is the reason a lot of people aren't getting killed in the Twilliger curves. He set up the program there to get traffic slowed down, did a lot of work in the past. I appreciate that every time I drive through there.
Well,
I'd like to add, though, if I may, that only some of the contacts, some of the stops as defined in OR arrests that police officers engage in involve traffic offenses, particularly in metropolitan areas like Portland and Eugene. Some of the contacts with pedestrians will begin in a dynamic situation, use of force in some measure, or foot pursuit or what have you.
Right.
And there may not be an opportunity even in those cases to notify them that they're being audio recorded.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. Just out of curiosity, how it currently operates, if you stop and approach someone, you must tell them that you have this device in operation. Does anyone ever refuse to give consent?
I can probably answer that. Is most people miss that we tell them they're being recorded. Situations, typically they'll say, well, what do you mean record? Well, you know, the best way I answer it is, well, you know, you watch cops on TV. It's like that. It records what we're doing right now. Typically, our experiences with the few cameras we have in the Portland Police, but I'm sure the captain from Eugene can probably concur, is that actually internal investigation complaints go down when the person notices that they're being recorded. They typically, everybody's on their best behavior. So I've had situations where I've had a person that got to be, say, the uncooperative type and vocal. I said, I need to remind you, you're still being recorded. And of all the situations that's happened to me, they've stopped talking. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, it's been positive in that aspect.
Okay. Any further questions for this panel?
Then thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your coming to present. At this point, Mr. DeLashmet, did you want to present on House Bill 2819, and then we'll go to people who have signed up on 2651?
For the record, Brian DeLashmet, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Oregon State Police Officers Association. 2819, which is the bill that I had introduced, we were unaware, actually, that the other bill was being introduced at the time. It was kind of the last minute. We got to make sure we plug this hole. So at this point, the only thing I have to add is that we have no objections to using 2651 as the vehicle. I'm aware that some folks have been doing some work. There's a -1 amendment. The only thing, and actually a very interesting question, difference in the definition that was brought up by Representative Bonamici, I may need to look at that very quickly, why they did it one way in the drafting of one bill and didn't do it that way in the other. And I don't know whether that captures more people, public safety officers, in the one bill than it does the other. But I can look at that very quickly. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Any questions for
besides that, what they said.
Okay. Very good, Mr. DeLashmet. Appreciate your flexibility on this, and it does appear that the other 2651, more likely the vehicle, so if you could look at that language and make sure that it meets your needs, that would
thank
be
you.
Good. Very good. Next, Andrea Meyer.
Good morning, Chairman Pearson, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. We appreciate the work group. I appreciate the opportunity to work with Mr. Campbell. It was a pleasure. And Mr. Landauer. The purpose of our work and where we've gotten to an agreement is, you know, the need to remove the threat to the officer of criminal sanction, but also to continue the training and the overall obligation to give notice. And so we believe with the removal of the all word, which I think we've all agreed to in hopes to still give an obligation or the training that if it isn't fluid or before it's fluid or that they do give notice, but only when the situation changes and they reasonably can't, would be the time that it's permissible to not. So with that, we appreciate the opportunity and appreciate the committee giving us time to work on this. Thank you.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Amy Elkanich on behalf of Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we support 2651 with the -1 amendments. It was a pleasure to be involved in this work group, and I think it was highly cooperative and that we've arrived at an ideal place to balance the rights of citizens and the real-life situations that police officers find themselves in. Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, as our pitch, do encourage and would like to see further recording occur in terms of custodial interrogation, especially in felony instances. We have a bill to that nature. So that is my pitch. We are always for having it recorded. We believe it holds citizens and police officers accountable, and we hope that the committee moves this bill.
Let me throw out a question here about the Dash 1 amendments that you, either one of you may have a reaction to. The suggestion was to strike the word all, so it would say instead of opportunity to inform all participants in the conversation that the conversation is being obtained, instead we just say inform participants. And it's not that I think all is essential, but it makes one wonder whether maybe there's some people being carved out of the notification requirement. And if you have a reaction, I'd just thought of that question.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, the word I actually would have liked to have seen was each participant, because I think that addresses, I mean, I think it's a semantic issue. I don't have a problem with the way it is now, but I think each would make sure that each participant is notified instead of all has a feeling of like a pronouncement where you arrive at a scene and you say, everybody, this is being recorded, you're on notice, whereas each, I think, would deal with where you have two or three kind of separate scenes that are fluid, where you're maybe at a house party and you have people in the driveway and you have people who are at the front door and you have somebody on the sidewalk. And I think that addresses that in each of those situations. But I do think it's a semantic argument. I don't think it has really a practical impact, although I'm happy to see each, all, or the word all just gotten rid of, frankly.
Chair McPherson, I mean, the dynamic I was trying to play with, and anyone reading this bill, it's so poorly written in its entire structure of this law, the negatives, the double negatives. But I just wanted to be very careful about not having a situation where an officer arrives, sees that there's people or fluidity, and decides that they don't need to notify anyone because the fluidity, when there's a reasonable opportunity to notify maybe the first person or the first few people. So we wanted to retain the obligation at all times unless it's really not possible. And so that was the concern about the all. And I have yet to fully figure out which might be the ideal, but I think each or removing it would help us, or we'll contemplate this for a while longer.
Okay. Any further questions for this panel?
I'd just like to say I really appreciate your guys' input on that and helping it bring us a bill that's ready to go instead of having to bring it back some other time to fix it.
Great, and I'm pleased to report to you that I think, although there's not been a full review of the amendments, that other larger bill that was certainly the folks that on the wiretapping folks were not on the same page, that I think we also had a positive work group, and my hope is as long as the amendments reflect what we all agree to, we'll be back again working out some changes that we all agree to.
Thank you very much. I think this needs to come back.
I would think on that, with everybody agreeing, we could do a conceptual change.
I think you could take one word out.
I mean,
that's what
we did a lot more of those.
Well, I guess the question with the input, I guess the question was Mr. DeLashman had a question about the language, the difference in language that Representative Bonamici had raised.
And it isn't just the definition, because in 2651, it's a different definition because it's a law enforcement officer as defined, by statute in a uniform and displaying a badge, and who's operating a vehicle-mounted video camera that records a scene, etc. 2819 just says a uniformed public safety officer. So there's no, it's much broader, and I just don't know what's going to happen to 2819. It looks like the work's been done in 2651.
Yes, 2819's going to go away.
Yeah. 2651 is the vehicle, and the question is whether there's any need to expand it. Maybe we should get Ms. Campbell and Mr. DeLashman. Got 10 minutes before we have to be on the floor, and just to see what should be done today. There's an issue here about whether there's a broader scope, it would appear, in 2819. We have otherwise 2651 ready to go with a subject to a conceptual amendment of one word that which we could suspend our rules and do here. So give us some input as to what you think ought to happen.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, there have been a number of bills introduced, and I think that the issue has come up for a reason. A lot of agencies, this has become a problem or issue or concern with the advent, especially of the vehicle-mounted cameras. And what we attempted to do in a work group process was to try to find something that we could agree to that was a fairly narrow, a narrow cutout on this. We don't want to take away the reasonable opportunity to provide notice.
We think that's a reasonable thing, but there are times when it's not reasonable for public safety officers to make that their main focus because of the safety situation or what's going on. And so I think that that's why we've gone to the narrower definition and why we have come with that one bill and the amendment to that bill. And so I think at this point, you may want to ask.
Yes, the question for Mr. you, Mr. Glashman, is if we proceed with the Dash 1 amendments as with striking one word today, then I think this will be the vehicle that addresses this issue without going with this consideration of broader language. Is that all right with you?
Mr. Chair, that's perfectly fine with me. And again, I don't know why the drafter drafted it in two different ways, because I think the problem was the same problem.
Okay.
And again, you've got law enforcement in one and you've got public safety in another. I'd have to look at that definition, but I think they're encompassing the same folks.
Thank you.
I can read the definition right now if you want. Okay, then I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bills 2651 and 2819 and open a work session on House Bill 2651.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1s as conceptually amended, removing the word all on the amendment and the third line of amendment between the words inform and participants. And with that, with all removed, I would move the amendment into the bill.
Representative Barker moves the Dash 1 amendments as conceptually amended by deletion of the word all on line 3 of the Dash 1 amendments, so the all between inform and participants, into House Bill 2651. Is there any discussion of that motion? Is there any objection? Then the Dash 1 amendments as so conceptually modified or amended are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move 2651 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2651 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 2651 as amended moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation. And Representative Barker, would you carry that?
Yes, I would. Thank you.
Very good.
Sure.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 2651 and close the meeting of the House Judiciary Committee. Thank you for your attendance, members.